afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 243rd edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a bi-weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as new Mainers. My guest today is Deborah Ibomwa. Her family is from Democratic Republic of Congo. They were refugees who arrived in the United States in 2000. When Deborah was nearly 9, she began attending local schools in Portland. She studied political science and pre-law at Clark University, and most recently, Deborah graduated from the University of San Francisco with a law degree before returning home to Maine to pass the bar. Currently, Deborah is a policy and legal advocate for the nonprofit Maine Equal Justice, which is devoted to serving those living in poverty in our state. It's such a pleasure to have you on New Mainers Speak, Deborah. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
People of all different socioeconomic backgrounds find themselves living in refugee camps. I wonder what kinds of things you remember from that experience that define the poverty that you witnessed there.
Yeah, I have very random memories and I can never put them exactly in chronological order because I was so young. But I do know that before the refugee camp, we were in a prison camp and we were actually sleeping on the floor there. The refugee camps were slightly better because we at least had like little rooms. I don't know. I have memories, some traumatic memories. Like I remember people screaming at the prison camp. I remember family members, me being sick, weird things like that. And the refugee camp, I just remember sticking to my mom like glue all the time. Well, that's just always been the case. But I started going to school at the refugee camp as well. Like there was a place we had like these brown, they almost look like paper bag dresses, I remember, that we would wear to class. And it was just weird area where it was like just brown dirt ground and no like tar clean road. I don't really know how it was set up. It was like a sort of like an encampment of different, not apartments, but I don't know what you would call them. And there was a big sense of community though. Like that's the thing, is that there was always, even at the prison camp, like I started speaking Lingala at the prison camp because most of the kids spoke that and I made friends that way. And then at the refugee camp, everyone was sort of like your aunt, your uncle. Everyone was like your friend. Everyone knew each other's name and everyone knew kind of our quirks and our characteristics. And we had like a little chorus, I remember, where people were singing. It was just like normal life, knowing that this wasn't normal, but making the best of it. And there was this sense of community and it takes a village. And yeah, I remember.
Nothing says normalcy like kids getting together and making a chorus. I love that you would do that in a prison camp.
Yeah. And it wasn't just kids. I think it was like anyone that wanted to be in it. But yeah. And that's the thing about Africans. They sing like at funerals, at weddings, sad or happy or what have you. Like there's always going to be a song and it's going to go on and on and on.
I love that.
Yeah,
I really do. When you arrived in Maine, you were 8 years old and you had to learn English and figure absolutely everything out. What did you notice about the other kids that you were attending school with when you first arrived?
I don't remember particularly. I think I was trying to just make friends with anyone and everyone that was my age. I was just so excited. I do remember wanting to join in. Like, this is a very specific thing. I remember waiting in line to play Foursquare. And when it was my turn, I think I do remember like two or three of the girls just walking away like they didn't want to play with me. And I didn't really think that much of it. I kind of felt bad, but I just didn't understand why.
And I still don't understand why.
No, I don't. I probably because I was like trying to be pushy and be friends and I didn't speak clear English or something. I don't know. I was probably more annoying than I thought.
Maybe you were really good at Foursquare and they didn't stand a chance.
Maybe. I mean, I did get to play Foursquare later on when we moved to Maine and I went to a different school and I was very good. But yeah, I just remember that I just knew that I was different, but I didn't really care. And I remember trying to like do my hair a certain way, you know, a line in the center and then put my hair behind my ears, which is like what a lot of white women do, that like
white girl
style
hair.
Yeah, and like the Rachel part, and then like putting it behind your ears. I remember doing that, and my mom would just be like, what are you doing? Like, let her do what she wants. But yeah, that's what I remember mostly.
Do you remember at all feeling surprised about what other kids had or what they were able to do or what they were even thinking about? Did that seem different to you from your more modest life?
As a 9-year-old? Yeah, I guess sometimes. Later on, I came to notice that kids would get picked up in nice cars, and my mom would always pick me up and we would walk home. That's like a big thing. And then like sometimes kids would mention like, oh, sorry you called me and I couldn't pick up because I was online. And I'm like, online? What line? What do you mean? I didn't realize like internet, you know, before we had a computer. I was like, what are you talking about? Don't lie to me. You just didn't want to pick up my phone call. So it's like I would notice it that way in surprising random ways, and that, oh, like there are these things that people have and I just don't know what they are. I didn't really consider that like it's something that they have and I don't. I'm just like, oh, I didn't even know that that was a thing.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet there are a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
Like, who knows what it means when you go away to a ski condo for the weekend?
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely don't ski. And it's weird because I actually, back home before the Civil War broke out, I'm from the capital, Kinshasa, which is like it was a very up and coming place. I've always been a city girl through and through. I could never live in rural parts, I don't think. But there's just some stuff like cultural things. My aunt had 2 cars back home. So like, but after moving here, obviously we were at a much lower level socioeconomically. And so I had forgotten. So like seeing people getting picked up in huge vans and stuff like that, I was just like, oh, I don't have that. That's interesting. Yeah, it's just weird. A lot of the times I did get treated like I came from a jungle or something, or like a village. But no, like that's just the circumstances in life just like happened. And I was like living a normal, regular life too. And I think that's a big misconception that people have of refugees in general, but specifically people from Africa, that like we all live in these huts, which some areas in Africa they do, some they don't. And so I felt that stereotype on me. That wasn't really a question you asked me, but I somehow...
Well, it's a big misunderstanding, right? It's the opposite. It's what did they think of you and what were you thinking of them, you mm-hmm. know? And mm-hmm. they didn't know what to make of you or what mm-hmm. kind of environment you'd come from.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing was like sleepovers. I made a lot of friends eventually when I moved to Maine, and I would get invited to sleepovers. I would get invited over my friend's house. And I always slept at home. Like it just, unless it was like family or something, it's just, to me, it was a new thing.
Did you go to the sleepovers or you just opted out?
Sometimes later in life, like in high school, when we had prom and we slept over at my friend's house, not as a younger, like 9, not in elementary school really, but I would go to my friend's house and just see how culturally different the relationship was with parents and stuff like that.
Oh, like what? What did they do that was different?
Sometimes, like just the way that you talk, there's this just inherent thing in African cult, like everyone that's older than you, like at least 10 or something older than you, can't talk to them in a certain tone. And it wasn't necessarily when I was in elementary school that kids were talking disrespectfully to their parents, but there was just like a tone that's more like you're talking to your friend and not really your elder, your parent. In high school is when I really like saw kids. It was just like very different. There's like, you can have an argument with your parent and then, you know, just move on and get along still. I sometimes got into arguments with my mom, but it had bigger consequences, you know, like I was afraid to do that. So that's just one other random difference.
Oh, it's a really huge difference if you're used to being respectful to adults, even in classroom, right? With the teachers.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The kids are so super casual and.
Oh, yeah. At the refugee camp, they would slap you with a ruler or like make you come to the front of the class and get slapped or just stand in front of everyone in shame.
If you said something rude?
Yeah, or you did something that you weren't supposed to do. Whereas school here is, you know, you might get detention, but you could talk back a little bit and it's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Real culture shift there.
Yeah.
Your family was Catholic, and in middle and high school, you attended Catholic schools in the area, both Cathedral and Chevres. Again, you were very aware that you were a minority in the group, and you felt different. Wonder what that was like for you as a adolescent.
Yeah, it was difficult. I mean, I think I had my awkward phase, especially in high school. Middle school was mostly fine because it was mostly us African kids, immigrants. And most of those people I still know to this day. I'm 29 now, and we're still, even people that I haven't seen in a while, when we get together, it's like just yesterday, we were able to build like a close-knit community again amongst us. But then in high school, it was really a mostly white school at Chevres. And it was like a handful of us kids of color, some of us African immigrants, some of us native born Black kids, and like international students. I was just more self-aware for some reason in high school that I was different. And I was always hypersensitive to how I say things, when I speak, who I talk to, who I approach, just like how I'm sitting, how I'm acting. Yeah, I was just always hypersensitive to the difference between me and the other kids.
Again, it's like the complete opposite of white privilege, where you don't even think to consider it.
Yeah, nope. I was always aware. And I, you know, if I was to go back now, I really would just be myself. And I think I've grown a lot, hopefully, after 10 something years. But back then, yeah, I just felt the difference. And at first I was like, oh, I want to go to public school. I don't want to deal with the dress code again. But looking back, it was really, really worth it for my education. I mean, it really helped prepare me for college, especially like essay and just writing in general. It was not hard at all. And I appreciate that. It's true to its name as a college preparatory school for sure. But back then, I was just a teenager going through awkwardness.
And
yeah.
And if you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Deborah Ebomwa. She is a policy and legal advocate at Maine Equal Justice, where she practices community lawyering, supporting Mainers who live in poverty. So let's start at the top here, Deborah. What is Maine Equal Justice all about?
Maine Equal Justice is a nonprofit organization providing civil legal aid, and it's an economic justice organization working to bring economic security, opportunity, and equity for people in Maine. And we focus on helping the low-income populations, and obviously that breaks down to different sub-communities like immigrants, people of color, native-born people of color, and people in rural communities, just making sure that their interests are represented at the legislative, administrative level. And when we're able to do impact litigation, that is, or class suits to make systemic change, we do that. And we also conduct community lawyering, which is a newer term for me personally, that I think is like the most important thing I can do as a lawyer.
Yeah, when we were talking about it before, I thought it sounded like community lawyering is listening to the people, finding out what they need, and then applying your strategic law knowledge to help them leverage what they want.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I understand it. And I just recently finished up a very long training series with my supervisor, who also is another lawyer at Maine Equal Justice, about community lawyering. And the first thing that we had to read for homework was describing a young lawyer or almost lawyer in law school with dreams of saving the world and thinking they don't want to be a corporate in the corporate world. And it was just like, basically, I felt, my God, this is me. Like, I feel attacked. Like, basically saying, if you do want to change the world, it's not going to be you that does it. It's not going to be the lawsuits that you file. It's not going to be you leading. And it never has been people like me. It's always been throughout the civil rights movement, throughout any time in history. It's always the people and the grassroots organizing. The result of that has always been the big changes when you look at Black lives movement and feminist movements, Black women movements. It's always been the people that decide what they need, that put their efforts into it, that organize and put pressure on the government or whoever is the decision maker. And in the background, you have people like me, lawyers or other professionals who can provide advice, who can kind of just draw out and map out the strategies, the legal strategies, and who would understand the relationships behind the scenes, but would prioritize the needs and the wants and the issues brought forth by the community and just be there as support. And so I'm learning to do that. And Maine Equal Justice really, I can honestly say, intentionally prioritizes giving voice to the people, not giving voice, but lifting up their voices and taking the lead of people of color when possible.
I think that's really exciting. I was on MaineEqualJustice.org and I watched the little video on there, and there was a gentleman who said, you know, let's face it, every organization and group of people have lobbyists that make sure their interests are heard at the legislative level. But people who live in poverty don't have anybody saying, you know, let's consider all the people that'll be affected by this law. And it sounds like that might be what you're doing. You're going there and you're like the lobbyist for the people.
Absolutely. That's the priority. And actually, it's really interesting because most of the staff come from or have some relation to that experience of poverty or discrimination or underrepresentation. So we all come with a certain passion and motivation. And, you know, that helps to drive the policies and the work along. I mean, Maine Equal Justice is really, really awesome. The way that they've been able to get things actually passed and done, especially like one big obvious one is that they led the effort to expand Maine care, which was huge. And, you know, now part of the focus is dental care, which is part of health care. And it's just kind of a fight making people realize that. But there's a lot of support for that too. People need dental care, and that's part of your overall well-being. And so I'm just grateful to be part of the organization that's actually able to get things done through collaboration and following the leadership of community leaders and impacted folks.
If someone's listening to this and they know someone who needs some help, can you say exactly who should call you?
Yeah. Anyone that has come upon hard times and has tried to get help from any government agency or any local agency or organization and has been denied access or can't figure out even where to start or how to navigate programs should definitely contact me, especially if you're dealing with the Department of Health and Human Services and programs run by the state, or if you are dealing with a general assistance program, or you may not even know what general assistance is or have ever dealt with the Department of Health and Human Services, but you just may be someone that is facing homelessness, or you want to go to school, but you have kids at home and you have no one to take care of them. You have dreams and aspirations to get a job and you just have no time because you have to take care of your kids and you just need help affording childcare or something and you just don't know where to start, definitely contact me. So if you're trying to look for a way to get out of poverty or just get a better future for yourself and your family and you just can't figure it out, if I can't help you, at least I would be able to refer you to the right people. Yeah, that's who we help, is people who can't find help anywhere else or don't know where to start. Maybe they could be eligible somewhere to get help and they don't know it.
That's kind of exciting. So even if I have been refused for TANF, I might be able to contact you and you could help me find another way or a different way to apply?
Yeah, sometimes people hear a no when they apply for certain things or they get denied and they don't know that it could be a wrongful denial. Maybe they made a mistake on their part that they're not aware of, but they could appeal that denial and then rectify that. It's really hard to do that, especially now with the pandemic, that more people are in need of help and they just don't know who can help them or how to even navigate those programs. Some people have just given up. Like I heard, I was denied, so there's nothing for me to do. I have to live this way. No, you don't. And I've heard that countless times from clients. Most likely there is an option. There's some way for you to get help. And, you know, it's always just worth trying. And I just don't know that many people know that Maine Equal Justice is a resource, one of several resources. So I want people to know that. Just call and I'll.
Yes. Sounds like we're going to get somebody who really, truly understands my life in poverty if I'm to call. It's not just, you know, highfalutin people trying to do good. It's people who really get it and then also know the system and know how to make things happen.
Yeah, and it's free legal aid. And like you said, it's coming from someone who has experienced hardship in their lives. We still deal with life too. So we understand what you're going through, maybe not specifically, but we understand at least what it is to try to fight the power or rise up from poverty and hardship and feel discouraged. But so we can relate to that. And that's what we bring with our representation and our policy work. So I think we're very unique in that way.
So I would reach out to you through MaineEqualJustice.org, perhaps. I could find your name and picture on there, Debbie Beaumois. How else could I reach you, since there's probably no walk-in in these days during COVID?
No, there is not. So there's an intake process. If you go to our website and click on legal aid services and just plug in what your email is, whatever your contact information is, and then someone will always get right back to you. We're very good at getting back to people. We do unemployment. We do general assistance, the Department of Health and Human Services benefits, a wide variety and more. And we also do foreclosure cases. But really, it's just whatever you need and you can't find help and you're someone that's really facing poverty and hardship, just ask us, see if we can find someone to help you.
Yeah, you might send them on to ILAP.
Yeah.
Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project or Maine Immigrants Rights Coalition or Pine Tree Legal Assistance.
Yeah.
Or maybe you can help them right there.
Exactly.
We'll hot link to all those things in the show notes for people who want to go to newmainerspeak.com.
Yeah. And Pine Tree Legal is wonderful as well. It's legal aid for people, low income folks. So when you're not eligible for them, you could come to us and that's who we would prioritize.
It's wonderful to have some options and some hope.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we're trying to do.
So when you dream big, you're only 29 and you're already set up as a community lawyer serving vulnerable population. When you dream big, what do you see yourself doing in 5 years? What might come of all this?
Within 5 years, I would hope that I'm in a place in the beginning stages of setting up something by myself or with friends and colleagues that fills a gap. And I'm especially passionate about filling a gap that would serve people like me, Black and brown women, young women, or of all ages, or youth in general, to get them to get the mentorship, to get the resources, to get the encouragement to chase their dreams and achieve those goals, professional goals. It's a very common thing within different immigrant communities to feel pressure to be a lawyer or a doctor or something like that, to just pursue your dreams and afford them the ability to pursue that, like actually have a chance at it and meet people who could open doors for them and gain the skills and the confidence in themselves. That's just my broad vision where I would start to have the resources to be able to do that.
That's great, because I think you found out how to do all that yourself, how to take the boards, how to get out of state for university, how to do everything. I mean, it's a lot of negotiating and navigating that you figured out. And now you're thinking, maybe I'll offer that to other people so they don't have to do it by themselves.
Right. It's like a big part of my motivation is going through law school, going through like an all-white private high school. That was all stuff that I kind of had to grow through and growing pains and kind of had to figure out, especially the law school part in the professional world that I had to sort of navigate pretty much on my own because there are no other lawyers. I mean, we have people in my family that have gone through university and have been professors, but they're not here with me. My mom has never been in the legal field. She sacrificed for me to get to where I am, but I had to really fight to be able to gain mentors that would be willing to help me, that would see me and share my values. There are a lot of things that I would do differently with my path in the legal field that I just didn't know better about. So yeah, I would love to afford people the opportunity to get that education so that they know how to achieve their dreams and goals and have confidence and not let how this oppressive system is set up put them down and discourage them from chasing their dreams. So just creating that support system for folks would be really, really great. And then maybe doing something from my home back home in Africa. I haven't figured out how exactly to do that.
Where did you get your heart for service?
I don't know. I think it's part of my personality. I always say to people, I'm a Libra. And so we're like the balance sign. And so anytime there's any inequity, unfairness or inequity in any type of situation, that's what triggers us. So like, I've just always been that way. But also, I really was just living regular life and trying to just pass my classes from kindergarten to high school. And then once I got to college is really when my eyes opened to the fact that I hadn't been up to that point really paying attention to politics and, you know, stuff that's going on around me. I was just a kid. I was just a teenager. So it opened my eyes as I was taking International Relations 101 and comparative politics that like, girl, this is your life. Like, this is what I have lived through and what so many people that I love and care about have gone through. And so why haven't I been more active? Why aren't I yet an activist? So that gave me a kick in the pants to pursue that road. And I really didn't know where I was going with it. I didn't know that I would be a lawyer or anything. I just knew that I wanted to do something and I would figure that out. But I just kind of kept taking these courses that were related to international relations and politics and really trying to figure out, why do these wars happen? What makes genocide? How can your next door neighbor one day turn against you or your teacher? What drives people to do that? And how do we resolve those conflicts? That's really what drove me. And I also took pre-law courses here and there without really registering for the program and had the pre-law director as my academic advisor. So it was just kind of, I fell into it. And I figured out, oh, I love to read. I hate math, can't do math. Would love to be a doctor, would love to do science, but I'm not good at it. And I love to help people. And it just fits in with my values and my life. So I think, okay, let me see what I can do as a lawyer. Again, thinking that lawyers lead the movements and bring justice to people and empower people, and not realizing that my real goal was to be a community lawyer, which I learned just a few months ago.
By following your heart, always with an open mind and just listening to what was calling you. You found your way pretty young to be 29 and to have really struck gold. I'm excited for you and all that you'll do.
Thank you.
Deborah, you care so much about equity and you act to protect the very most vulnerable citizens in the community. You mix kindness with your determination to seek justice. And it's a pretty powerful cocktail. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. So glad we connected. I'm glad to be here.
I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Deborah selected for us. Can you tell us what this song is and why you chose it?
Yeah, this song is from the new adaptation of the Lion King soundtrack. It's by Tierra Whack and Beyonce, and featuring a lot of other artists. The message is basically, you'll never take my power. I decided to go with this because it just reminds me of the power of Black women and how we just are the backbone of pretty much every movement. It always makes me feel empowered and happy and confident. And I hope that does that for others too. You'll never take my power.
Always in the lead, who you wanna be, I'm who they wanna be, B-E-A-U-T-Y-E, never seen so much rage from a queen, rage from a queen, queen so strong, thought she was a machine, girl of your dreams, Sinclair regime, turn to the max, can't forget Maxine.
But fun to me as a goddess, I'm tired of being modest, 100 degrees the hottest, if we're being honest, ebony antibiotics, black people win, they say we're being honest.